This is Casey Currents. I'm Susan Wilson.
And I'm Alex Smith. Murder-suicide is rare, but on the rise across the country. Missouri is in the top 10 for women killed by intimate partners, and murder-suicide has increased in Kansas. When murder-suicide occurs, it leaves loved ones and friends with many unanswered questions. Amid the shock, anger, and grief, people ask themselves why. They wonder, what did we miss, or what could we have done? For answers, we turn to Overland Park forensic psychologist Dan Claiborne. Casey Currents' Susan Wilson started by asking Dan to identify some of the major contributing factors in murder-suicide cases.
Access to guns, previous threats with weapons, whether there's a stepchild in the house turns out to be a factor that statistically shows up, and then whether there's estrangement between the perpetrator and the victim. 92% of these situations involve guns. 74% of the murder-suicides involve the murder of an intimate partner. So almost always it's someone who's intimately involved with the murderer.
I know over the past 2 years in Kansas, there's been an increase in murder-suicides. And actually across the country, this has been an issue. And certainly last weekend, we had a local example of that. What's the typical profile of someone who commits a murder-suicide?
Well, first of all, you know, we estimate that there are about 1,000 to 1,500 of these situations each year in the United States. Almost all of them, over 90%, are committed by males. So definitely the perpetrator is almost always male. The primary risk factor is whether there's been prior domestic violence. Murder-suicides, you know, can't be predicted because it's such a rare occurrence, really. It's such a low-level frequency occurrence that you can't predict it. But the risk factors, if you look at them that way, the primary one would be any history of domestic violence in the relationship already. 40% of murder-suicides, the individual doing the murder-suicide is a person who's jealous and abusing substances. So that's very common.
You mentioned males, and you were saying that most murder-suicides are perpetrated by males. Why men?
Well, most murders in general are committed by men, about 90%. Men are just more aggressive. And take that as a method of solving problems, aggression rather than communication. We don't really know. It's interesting, the brains of women have a larger area that generates violent or aggressive impulses. But women also, the part of the brain that filters those impulses is also more highly developed in women. So the output of women in terms of violent actions is much lower than that of men. It's kind of interesting that way.
Now, you also mentioned substance abuse as a factor here. How does that play a role in instances of murder-suicide?
The research doesn't really explain how it plays a role, but those of us in violence risk prediction kind of fields think that it's a little bit like a recipe of ingredients. You have the emotional arousal on the part of the person that generates the need to do something. Then you have maybe a situation that allows for something to be done, namely maybe it's you're in private so nobody's watching. Then you have access to a weapon, a means to commit an action. And then you have what we might call a disinhibitor, whether it's drinking or using substances or something like that, to allow the person to overcome their socially trained instincts not to harm someone. So it's like a recipe of ingredients. So we think that the substance use comes in, or alcohol use comes in, as a way of lowering the threshold for the person to do something that normally, without that substance, they might not be able to do it.
You talked about past history of domestic violence. And I guess past behavior is the best predictor of future behavior where violence is concerned. So is it a pattern of domestic violence that is predictive, or is it one or two instances? How would people, families, begin to see these instances as warning signs?
Well, that's a really good question. It has to do with several aspects of the history. First of all, is there a history of domestic violence at all? But more importantly, what's been the frequency of it, and what's been the intensity of it, how serious it's been, and what's been the recency of it? So the more recent it is, the more of a warning sign it is, the more intense it's been, the more physically harmful or destructive it's been, and the more frequent it's been. There's a lot of us think that with a situation where there's been domestic violence, that there's a tendency for the violence to escalate because the what's been done before, it doesn't feel like enough. And so the person needs to make a stronger point the next time. And then the other thing is, once you've crossed a line like being physical or using a weapon or using threats or any of those things, then it's much easier to cross that line next time. And so the tendency is to escalate as time goes on. So that's the way we think it works.
Now, what about financial issues? Are they a catalyst in situations of murder-suicide?
The researchers think that all sorts of extraneous variables can be, whether it's financial pressures, work pressures. But since this is a very low occurrence phenomenon, it's really been hard to show that those are causal factors like the other things. One interesting thing that's come out of the research is that the average age discrepancy between the person doing the murder and the victim is 6 years. The murderer is 6 years older than the victim.
I wonder why that might be.
Well, I don't know. Men tend to have relationships with women who are somewhat younger anyway, so it may just be an artifact. But it's the average difference has been noted to be 6 years.
Now, as we think about personality factors here, because I know you mentioned a lot of statistical factors, but is there a certain type of personality, maybe type A or maybe a personality that tends to be very controlling, that would place someone at higher risk for being a perpetrator of murder-suicide?
Well, I think we have to really, in a way, separate out the murder part from the suicide part. And I'm not speaking here from a research base because I don't know that this has been studied that much. But yes, I think there are certain factors that influence a person to be willing to take the step of murdering someone. And I think that has to do with a person who is highly emotional, who is impulsive. Yeah, most people who commit murder are young, so they're more of an age that where people are impulsive and they do things quickly. Probably, in many cases, this is me speaking as a person who's more of a therapist than a researcher, probably it's more common with people who are highly self-centered, who have been used to being in control of themselves and other people, and also have a very strong need to protect their image. And so if they feel that someone has betrayed them or been disloyal to them, they are going to be likely to be much more intolerant of that or upset with that or unable to cope with that than somebody who didn't have such a sense of pride or such a sense of self-importance. Then the suicide part, it probably is related to similar things. If a person is very self-centered and has a lot of pride and a lot of concern about their image, once they've committed some horrible act, they may be a lot less able to imagine a life after that in which they make amends, are accepted again by the community, are able to recover, overcome this, and do anything healthy and productive. They may not be able to imagine that happening. It may be a bigger blow to their ego to imagine the disapproval and the condemnation of others after this event has happened. And so those factors might propel them to have to remove themselves from the situation rather than to face consequences. We also know that suicide is usually a very impulsive act. For example, people who kill themselves with weapons. Some studies have looked at people who have shot themselves but survived. And the people who have done that, when they're interviewed, they've been asked, how long before you attempted to kill yourself were you actively thinking about doing it? And over 80% of those people said it was less than 1 hour. And over 25% of those people said that it was less than 5 minutes. So suicide of that type, I mean, those kind of sudden, like jumping off a bridge, shooting oneself, those kinds of no return suicides are often very impulsive. Another example of this is in the state of Washington, there were two bridges across a river, and there were a number of suicides on each of those bridges each year. And then at one point in time, on one of the bridges was erected a suicide barrier so that people couldn't commit suicide by jumping off of that bridge anymore. And the other bridge, which was very short distance away, easily a person could walk to it, in the subsequent years, that bridge didn't show any increase in suicides. So it looked as though people who might have jumped off that first bridge but were prevented, they didn't walk 15 minutes to the other bridge and jump off. They found some other path. So there's a lot of research evidence that many suicides are extremely impulsive. Well, if you've got a passionate individual and somebody who's used to making quick decisions and they have access to a weapon and perhaps they have the disinhibition of using drugs or alcohol, any or all of those things, you might have an impulsive act happen.
You know, one intriguing thing about the literature, it talks about how in most instances of murder-suicide, that person has no criminal background or no major brushes with the law, because I think there's a tendency to try to demonize people who do things like this and think of them as, well, they were probably criminals, but not the case, huh?
No, that's correct. When the research looks at causal factors, a prior criminal record does not turn out to be a predictive factor at all.
You know, in a situation like this, you'll hear people say, I could never imagine this person doing this. I mean, this is just so out of character. Could that really be true, or were there warning signs that might have been missed?
Well, nothing like what has happened here or generally a murder-suicide, they cannot be predicted. 99.9% of people who have all the recipe of ingredients that we've talked about will not commit a murder-suicide. So it really can't be predicted. But afterwards, family and friends and people thinking about it can often note patterns in the person's behavior that they put it together and they think, well, this does make some sense. These things that they observed afterwards or recalled afterwards wouldn't be enough to have predicted it ahead of time. But it would help maybe make some sense of it afterwards. You know, you might notice a period of time where the person was more isolated or in their relationship a history of escalating violence or threats. But here again, in most situations, even the ones that have those elements, no one will kill themselves or someone else. So it's real. I don't think people, family members or friends, should in any way feel bad about not having been able to predict such an event, because no one could predict it. But rather, sometimes going over it afterwards helps make some sense and helps us be prompted to pay attention to each other. That's the benefit, if there is one, of something like this, that we may want to confront our friends and family more upfront when we notice changes in their behavior or signs of distress or signs of substance abuse or whatever it may be. I guess the lesson here would be not to ignore those things, to really ask the person about it, bring it to their attention.
Well, Dr. Claiborne, we want to thank you for being with us on Casey Currents.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Dan Claiborne is an Overland Park forensic psychologist. He has worked with police departments and serves on the hostage negotiation team for the Olathe Police Department.
Part of Casey Currents today, you can catch individual stories or hear the whole show online at kcur.org, and we've got a podcast. Find us on iTunes.